Ginigai Nyangai, Nanyu Wambad M. Randall, Aji Naya Yagia, Aji Wurundjeri Wadia, Aji Nadia Adagi Yaya Yangadawu, Aji Nadia Adagi Nulungin Namiga. So, hi everyone, my name is M. Randall. I'm a Yaga woman and I pay my respects to the Wurundjeri people in their land, and I remember my ancestors and my elders. And I'm a part of the Black People's Union, and I guess in like connection to today, I'm a peer worker, have lived experience of disability, and I also run Blackfella Alt to Sue. So yeah, just here for a yarn.
Yeah, sounds deadly, and sounds deadly doing your intro in language.
Yeah,
need to hear a lot more of that on this show.
Yeah, I think language is healing, and it's about spirit, and yeah, I don't know. Just it makes you feel connected. I think when I started speaking language, it brought on a lot of healing for me. I think something that gets forgotten when it comes to disability is our spirit and making sure our spirit is strong and connected. And I think language is one of those important ways to reconnect and stand strong. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it goes a long way to healing that intergenerational trauma as well. You know, something somebody I work with, Beck, she's another First Nations person. She talks a lot about how there's not just intergenerational trauma, but there's also intergenerational healing to be found in our culture and in practicing and revitalizing our culture.
Well, yeah, I'm the first in three generations to speak Yagir, and obviously I'm not fluent. I'm still like a baby when it comes to the language. But, you know, as like our elders have said, like even when you just say hello, that's healing. Like even if it's just one word a day, like it's better than nothing, and it keeps it alive. And I think I don't know who we are without our language.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Our language is tied to the land. So without our language, I think we lose a massive part, if not all of who we are.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And, you know, that's actually, I've got a few questions for you today, but that's actually a really great segue into the first question. So the theme of today is right relations. And along that line, you know, when you think about right relations, what does culturally grounded care look like for our mob, you know, especially for people who are living with different access needs?
I think these services need to be for mob and by mob. And you see it happening a little bit, but I don't think it's happening enough. I'm really sick of, there's this theme of white fellas trying to guess what we need, and they might do like one co-design with like First Nations fellas, or they might do like one like steering group, but it's not enough, because at the end of the day they're still just guessing, and it obviously brings poorer outcomes for our people. Like co-design is not enough. We need to run our own services. But also I think when we talk about culturally grounded care and being in right relations, I'm probably going to like repeat this a lot throughout the show, but there's not going to be proper culturally grounded care and right relations until we can get our land back and our law back. Like existing in these systems is inherently disabling. Like it disables you, and then for mob who are disabled, it is extra disabling. Like there is no way to really truly survive and thrive in this colonial system, and I think we can do our best as mob to keep fighting and keep resisting in this system, but we're never going to know true healing until we get our land back. But I also think, I guess side point, that there is a lot of healing in fighting for your land back and that resistance. Like yeah. I think there's a lot of healing in that, to know that you're carrying on from past generations and you're carrying that fire for the future generations. Like yeah, I think maybe sometimes as disabled people we feel like we're not doing enough and we're not contributing enough, and that's that capitalist colonial mindset that yeah. makes you feel like if you can't have a job or if you can't study, then you know, you're useless, you're slack. But I think every day we get up and we continue to resist, I think that's so important, and we need to remember that that's so worthwhile.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And you also touched on something there as well about like the co-designing stuff, you know. At the end of the day, it's not self-determination,
no.
It's co-design. And, you know, what we need is to be able to determine our own affairs, and that means designing stuff ourselves, not some tokenistic little, you know, board that gives a bit of feedback that may or may not be even listened to and actioned.
But here's the thing. These white services think that co-design is self-determination. Yeah. They're like, here, look, we gave you this. You know, we're pushing self-determination. They don't even know what the word means. Yeah. Like, slack.
You know, I think as well, like, you know, again, like, that's just an excellent bridge to my next question, which is a bit about that sort of stuff. You know, like, you do a lot of work in peer support, and you've been organizing community spaces for years now, or at least, you know, years that I've known you. What have you seen our communities do well in actually supporting one another that colonial systems actually consistently failed to do?
So I'm in a really interesting position where I actually have three peer work jobs, and one of those roles is actually within Queensland Health, and then the other role is Blackfella Alter Sioux. So, like, I'm working on, like,
both sides,
complete ends of each side. And it's been so eye-opening working within white systems. But then that's why Blackfella Alter Sioux is so important. Like, working in the white systems has reinforced to me why self-determinating services and grassroots services like Blackfella Alter Sioux and, you know, all the other deadly stuff mob are doing is so important. Peer work is inherently decolonial. I think some peer workers forget that, actually. Some peer workers I've found like to act like mini cops. But anyway, that's a yarn for another day. They get a little bit of power, and they, especially like working in like psych units, and like I've seen some peer workers like doing searches on patients, and I'm like, that's not your job. Like, you're getting a little power hungry. You think just because you went through it that now you've got that power that you can like punch down. It's actually really sad to see. But yeah, I feel like, yeah, peer work fits within Blackfella culture so well, because like our cultures are based on the value of lived experience, right? Like, our elders are everything to us because of the lived experience they've gained from their lives, and our cultures and all of our wisdom and our lore is built off lived experience because we're remembering from the past generations and bringing it down. So it fits perfectly.
Yeah.
Side note, I've actually been trying to translate peer work into Yigiya. I can't. And that's because I think we don't have words like that, because everyone was a peer worker. Like, everyone was using their lived experience to, and what they'd been through and that hope, to support others through the same journey. Like, that was just our communities, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And we continue to do that. Like, I think every Blackfella is a peer worker in a way. So there's something so special, even just working in like my Queensland Health job, about working with First Nations consumers, like we have to call them that, but and just being able to, like, you can't decolonize Queensland Health, it doesn't work like that, but I just try and push it and like just take like the women out for weaving and stuff, and just kind of like, yeah, do that sort of healing stuff that maybe a white clinical system wouldn't see as like, you know, doing your job.
Yep.
But that is our job, and that's been some of the most powerful moments, is just going to like the beach and just weaving, and
definitely. And you know, I've seen similar sort of stuff as well. So you know, in my past I've had some jobs that I am and aren't proud of, but you know, I've worked in Aboriginal rehabs with a lot of our followers who were, you know, trying to battle addiction stuff, and one of my first actual proper jobs was actually working in the jails. I wasn't a screw though, so don't judge me. But I worked in there, like, doing a lot of like mental health programs and stuff. And you know, they've got their like rigid programs that they have that you're meant to do and stuff. But quite often, the most, not just the most fulfilling stuff for me, but like the most impactful stuff that I've done with the fellas in there was actually just around like culture, just getting together and having, you know, yarns and talking about culture and just, you know, being together in those cultural sort of ways. That's,
you got to be real creative when you work in the white systems.
Yeah.
And it's right. Like, those things that maybe like a white clinician won't see as impactful end up being the most impactful, because again, these white clinicians don't understand us.
Yeah.
And they don't understand what is healing for us. And that's, again, wrapping it back to self-determination, why we need to be able to do things our way.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that's what's always got the best outcomes as well, self-determination. And there's been so many studies, not just here, but like around the world, that actually show that self-determination is single-handedly the best thing for actually addressing people's needs. You know, when you come in, when somebody comes in, especially like with white settlers and whatever else, and they try and dictate to us what, you know, we should and shouldn't be doing to heal, you know, it's only ever so, it only has so much of an impact. But then when we can actually sit down and work out our own programs and run them ourselves and do it all ourselves, that's when we actually see the proper real results.
But that is colonialism, right? Like a white clinician telling a black fella how they should heal. Like that's colonialism, and they don't see it. They've got that white savior complex of, look at us helping these blacks. But, you know, that's colonialism in action. That is in action in systems like Queensland Health and what do you call it down here? Health Victoria?
Yeah, Victoria.
Yeah.
And it's you know, it's colonialism, and it's also racism at the end of the day. It's actually a proper form of paternalistic racism. You know, that whole white saviorism concept. But, you know, along those lines, you know, how do relationships and kinships and stuff and, you know, that collective responsibility help shape the way that you approach your peer work?
Well, kinship and collective responsibility is the basis of peer work, especially First Nations peer work. 'Cause in peer work, there's no helping, right? Like, you're not helping someone, you're walking in it together.
Yeah.
Like, we're in this together. I'm not going to do anything to you or for you. Like, we're going to come to a conclusion together about the work we're going to do, which, it's different in a sense because I'm not here to make decisions for you, which can be really shocking for people who have been in health systems where it's just been clinicians, especially white clinicians, doing things to them and making decisions for them and saying, here's what we're going to do, you're going to do this, especially if they've been on something like an involuntary treatment order where they've had all their, you know, their rights taken away essentially for being disabled. So peer work can, like, I remember when I first met my first peer worker, I was in the psych ward in Logan. And I was like shocked. I was like, so you're not gonna make any decisions for me? And they were like, no, you guide this. And I was just like, I'm gonna need a moment. Like, this is wild. And obviously, you can't do true peer work in a psych facility, right? Like a psych ward, because there's still the involuntary treatment orders, which means that there's a power imbalance because. Yeah. Peer work, like the power balance is a massive part of peer work because usually you've got the clinician up here and you've got the patient down here. And peer work drives to kind of level that playing field. But the playing field's never going to be level when you're working somewhere like a psych unit, right? Because at the end of the day, you can't leave. So you end up, peer work in psych facilities is often just trying to do the best you can, but it's not true peer work. Like true peer work can only exist in like I guess like grassroots settings where there's both equally consensual, you know, both people equally want to do it. They're not being like, because I guess in the psych unit the clinicians kind of go, hey, go talk to the peer workers, go, you know, so like it's not entirely their decision.
Yeah, it sort of strips away that autonomy.
Yeah, so yeah, peer work kind of flips the script when it comes to not like, I guess, other, I mean, I wouldn't call peer work treatment. I'd hate that word. It's a relationship.
Yeah.
But it flips the script, which I think is healing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM, Apartheid Free Zone. That was the host of Yuliman, Kieran Ashton-Stewart, speaking with guest Emma Randall about the importance of building self-determination within care for First Nations community as part of 3CR's 12-hour broadcast on the International Day of People with Disability. You can listen to more from Yuliman Show on Wednesdays from 12 to 1 or go to 3cr.org.au/Yuliman. You can also find more from the station's Disability Day broadcast at 3cr.org.au/Disability Day 2025. I'm just going to play a quick community service announcement and then we'll get on with part two of that interview. Stay tuned.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR 855 AM. Up next, we're going to play part two of a segment from 3CR's 12-hour broadcast on the International Day of People with Disability from Yilliman, where the show's Yilliman's host, Kieran Ashton-Stewart, speaks with M. Randall about peer work as a means of abolishing carceral systems and how the impacts of colonialism compound for First Nations communities. And yeah, have a listen.
And it would look like if services and supports actually respected First Nations ways of caring, relating and responding to distress.
I mean, for starters, places like prisons and psychiatric wards would not exist.
Yeah.
Because they go against our ways of care, but also just appropriate ways of responding to distress and conflict. Like, locking people away doesn't fix things.
Yeah.
Forcing people to take medication they don't want to take doesn't fix things. And, you know, how many of our people have taken their own lives in prisons and psych facilities that were supposed to, and I'm doing air quotes, look after them and keep them safe, when really that being contained and being taken away from everything you know drove them to even darker depths than when before they even got in there, you know. We need to abolish prisons and psych facilities. It's interesting. I hear when people talk about abolition sometimes that they think that prisons should be replaced with psych wards, because it's like, oh, well, the people in prisons, they're just mentally ill, so they just need to go on an involuntary treatment order. They don't need to go to prison. And it's like, involuntary treatment orders are a form of incarceration. Psych wards are prisons. If you can't get to the door and leave without being chased by a police officer, you are in a prison.
Yeah.
And so more psych facilities is not the answer to getting rid of prisons. We need to, like, be more creative, you fellas. Come on. Like, you know, like, why would we replace, like, one site of incarceration with another?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so I'd love to obviously see the abolition of prisons and psych facilities and there be actual liberation and freedom and actually appropriate ways of responding to distress. And I think peer work is a big part of how we could be responding to distress, because there's something so powerful about when you're in like a dark place and there's someone there that gets it. Like, just the power of someone being like, I get it, I've been there and I actually got out of it, and every day is not perfect, but, you know, this is not the end. Like, that, just that in itself, and just having someone there, you know. But yeah, we need the self-determination to run our own services, and yeah, get rid of the prisons and the psych wards.
Yeah,
burn them.
Yeah. And I just want to just reiterate what you said as well about, like, you know, psych wards, they are forms of incarceration. Now, at the end of the day, if some sort of institution strips away your freedom, strips away your autonomy, you know, that's a jail just by another name.
Yeah.
It's no different to how they rebranded jails as rehabilitation centers. You know, it's the same thing at the end of the day. You know, it's just a different pool of funding or whatever that funds it, and it's just got a different name. But if it looks like a chook and acts like a chook, it's a chook.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think people don't... I don't think people have the same empathy for people with what is classed as severe mental illnesses. Like, I'm going to go out on a limb here and be honest that I live with schizoaffective disorder, which is when schizophrenia and bipolar have a horrible little baby. And I have lived experience of involuntary treatment orders. And people, schizophrenia, people are really scared of that word. Like, yeah. You say that word, it's like, boo. You know, and they'd never, I feel like once you, you know, see that, like, they never talk to you again. Like, I tell people that and then they've suddenly got a story about how they got robbed by a schizophrenic on crack. And I'm just like, I didn't need to know that story. But that's, so people with schizophrenia are like the boogeymen, right? So people, I'm going to be just blunt, people don't really care what happens to people with schizophrenia and bipolar, like people who are experiencing manic episodes.
Mm.
Very similarly to the fact that people don't care about people who go to prisons because, well, you're a criminal, you know? So there's not, the abolition of prisons and psych wards and stuff are not front on people's mind because they don't care.
Yeah.
They go, well, I don't want you in my community. I don't want to live next to a schizophrenic. It's like you probably do live next to a schizophrenic. You just don't know. So there's just that lack of empathy that's really, you know, right throughout society. And like, you know, I talk about my lived experience and people go, oh, well, but, you know, you needed to be locked up. You know, you needed that. And it's like, people don't, they don't care.
No, they don't. And, you know, you're right. It's that whole thing about, you know, these people, it's kind of like a whole Karen mentality of, you know, they just want to be, you know, I'm using my air quotes now, you know, safe in community. But, you know, that's not being in community, you know, locking people up. That's not being in community. And you're right. There's this whole like boogeyman sort of a thing to it where, you know, people think that people who have certain mental health conditions or people who have, you know, previously offended or something like that, you know, I'm using my air quotes, the safest thing to do is to lock them up somewhere. But that's not how you build community. That's not how you function in community. And at the end of the day, all you're doing is persecuting segments of your population.
Yeah,
it's absolutely disgusting.
But again, it comes down to that white mentality that they don't care. What they want is a white community.
They want
the white Australia policy.
Yep.
They just want little white families that, you know, there's no complexity, there's no white people are so boring, right? Like, they don't want any like thing that makes life interesting, or they don't want to meet people that, you know, have different lived experiences. They just all want the same house and the same family, and everyone's had the same, like, I'm sorry, I'm bored. I'm bored and it's weird and it doesn't make sense to me. Like,
yep.
I guess being a peer worker, like, that you live with that curiosity, and like, I love the people that I get to meet, right? Because I meet people that I would have never met otherwise, and everyone has a different story and has different complexities in their life, and it's an honor to be brought into that, and that, you know, to be a part of that journey, even if it's just for a little while. Like that, like that, that's the beauty of life, right?
Yeah.
And the white fellas just don't want it. No. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I suppose as well, like, we're 25 minutes past 12 here. You're listening to Yilliman on 3CR. I'm in the studio here with friend and comrade of mine, Em, who's done a lot of work in grassroots spaces and peer work spaces. So, you know, along those lines, you know, you have been a part of grassroots Blackfella-led programs like Blackfella Alter Sioux. You know, what actually inspired that space and what kind of innovations came from the community itself?
Yeah, so I have a lived experience of suicide, and I mean, I didn't succeed because I'm here, but I have a lived experience of suicidal ideation and attempts. And I obviously also knew that, like, obviously suicide is a massive problem for our peoples.
Mm.
You know, because it was never really a thing for our people. And then it hit us really hard.
Yeah.
And then I think Do we have the highest rates in the world?
Yeah,
or we're
do.
Up there?
No, we do. We have the highest rates in the world, not only as a general population, but we've also got the highest rates for women, for men, and for children in the world. And, you know, as you said, it's not something that's a part of our culture. Like, I know in my language and a few other languages I've looked at, we didn't even have
a word. We don't have a word.
Yeah, there's no such thing as suicide before colonization. Like, it was just not even thought of. We didn't have a word for it because it was so foreign and, you know, such a... not a thing for us. And now we've got the single highest rates in the world for all of our demographics. And it's something as well that's only happened over the last couple of decades.
Yeah.
Like, even as recently as, I think it was like 1950 or something like that, our suicide rates were still pretty much zero.
Yeah.
Yeah, but now, yeah, the worst in the entire world. And I think it's only getting worse as well. Every time I look at the stats, it's absolutely disgusting.
And I think it kind of looks at that, like, compounding of colonialism. Like, every generation that goes by, like, the colonialism gets compacted.
Yeah.
And also, I guess, the colonialism has like, it's the same thing, but it's kind of changed forms a little bit. And it's hard to keep up with and to have that hope, right?
Yeah.
So with Blackfella Ulta Sioux, obviously I have a lived experience, and I knew a lot of other mob with lived experience, and I knew obviously that we have the highest rates in the world, and I'd had histories of grassroots organizing, being a part of the Black People's Union for like 3 years, I think. I think Blackfella Ulta Sioux's been running for about 2 years. But I actually went back home to our women's camp. And I remember talking to, like, all my different aunties, and pretty much every auntie had a story about a son who was in jail or was struggling with alcohol and other drugs or was struggling with their mental health. And stories about how, like, back on country, the closest psych ward is Lismore Hospital, which is a couple hours away. And stories about how, like, they'd be taken by the police to Lismore Hospital and then they'd be left there with no way home. Mm-hmm. You know, stories like that. And I was just like, I got to do something, because it's about that right relations, right, and that collective responsibility. Like, you know, my aunties are telling me these stories. You can't just sit there on your hands, right? Like, you got to do something. So I thought, okay, I got to do something. And then I was in Maganjin in Brisbane, and as I was becoming a part of the peer work world, I wasn't a peer worker yet, but I was engaging in a lot of peer work. I was engaging with a deadly organization called Brook Red, which is all peer work run, so there's no clinicians or anything. They're all peer workers, which it just really creates like a different sort of service.
Yeah.
Because there's none of that clinical, you know, clinicians act like cops, really. Yeah. Like, that's so... to have no clinicians really was that, like, sense of safety. And they ran a program called Ulta Sioux, or Alternatives to Suicide. Ulta Sioux actually started in Turtle Island in, you know, so-called America, and was brought over here. And Ulta Sioux is essentially, like, just a space with some values of those peer work values of, you know, responsibility to but not for or over. Like, you know, no one's responsible for the decisions you make. Essentially... it's a space where you have a yarn and you have a cuppa, and it's the facilitators are all people with a lived experience of suicide, and people who are struggling with suicide come and you just have a yarn. But what makes Ulta Sioux different is that you cannot call an ambulance or the police or a mental health service on anyone in the group. So there's that, you know, that sense of safety that, because you know, there's that feeling like you're going to talk about being suicidal and then they're going to call the cops on you, and then you're going to get put on an involuntary treatment order, and then you're going to be even more suicidal and you can't leave. So to enter a space where everyone agreed no one's calling the cops, and also just that confidentiality that what's yarned about in the group stays in the group, like, that was such a transformative space. It was the only time I'd ever really felt like I could talk about suicide, and that I was truly going to be safe, and that I was going to talk about what I want to talk about, and then I can get in my car and drive home, and I'm not going to have to spend the night in the psych ward.
Yeah.